Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Christopher Huerts. He's the author of The Sacred Enneagram, Finding Your Unique Path to Spiritual Growth. A little bit about Christopher. He's an activist who's been involved in humanitarian relief and anti-trafficking efforts, in addition to his work as an Enneagram teacher. And he has been mentored by some of the great spiritual masters of our time, including Mother Teresa, with whom he spent time at her community in Calcutta, and his mentor, the Franciscan priest, Father Richard Rohr. He was introduced to the Enneagram almost 20 years ago while working in the slums of Cambodia. "That's where the Enneagram found me," he says. His Enneagram journey has been influenced by work of Rohr and other Enneagram experts, such as Helen Palmer, Don Rizzo, and Russ Hudson. We welcome once again to Common Threads, Chris Huerts. Hi, Chris. Welcome back.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me again.
Certainly. I don't want to completely repeat what we talked about last week, but I think that for people who did not catch the program then, we probably should start off with the same question, if you would give us a brief understanding of what the Enneagram is.
Sure. So if you've ever seen the Enneagram, it's a circle with a sort of irregular six-pointed star and a triangle right there in the middle. And what it does is it shows us nine points, nine sort of landing places for our soul, nine sort of what in the Enneagram language is called types. And types are, like Russ Hudson says, one of my teachers, Russ Hudson, less about nine kinds or types of people, more about nine paths to God. And so the Enneagram in 2017 has been sort of how it's been sort of communicated and taught is it's been taught as an aid or a guide to understand our human character structure in nine different ways. It shows us the nine different ways behind how we think, how we act, how we feel. It shows us the nine different ways that we get stuck in mental and emotional loops. It shows us nine different ways of understanding ourselves in the in relationship with others. And it shows us nine ways to sort of find ourselves and find our way back to God, back to our true selves or back to our essential nature.
You know, the last question I recall asking you in our previous program together, I had it on the tip of my tongue, but we ran out of time. So I remembered this entire week, I got to ask Christopher this. You talked about finding our true selves, that the Enneagram helps us come to terms with it. We were talking about identity and the myths surrounding our identity and the stories we tell ourselves about what our identity is, and that you talked about the true self. Now, we also last week talked about the fact that the book that you've written, The Sacred Enneagram, is published by Zondervan, which is an evangelical Christian publisher. Many of the people who today are students of the Enneagram are people who are not part of that evangelical community. It's something that's very popular in the traditions that identify with the term New Thought or New Age or Eastern traditions. Last week you mentioned the Sufis. Sufism is a mystical branch of Islam. I'm going to guess that there are people involved in the Enneagram who are Kabbalists, connected to the Jewish mystical community. The list goes on. Now, when you talk about true identity, you get different answers from people of different faith traditions. If you talk to someone from probably the Sufi tradition, the Hindu tradition, etc., the New Thought, New Age community, they're going to say that our true identity is that we are a part of the divine, that there is no real separation, that the spiritual work we do is in fact that which reveals our identity ultimately as being one with the divine. If you're an evangelical Christian, a significant part of your identity is that you are separated from God, that you are a sinner, that you are, of course, assuming that you believe the right things, do the right things, that you are saved, and that you can find union with God in the afterlife, but ultimately, we are separate. My question is, can someone who comes from that background, that understanding, appreciate the Enneagram, grow with the Enneagram, yet still maintain that identity as a creation of God, one who is sinful? As well as, can someone who says, no, my identity is that I am one with the divine, I don't have to do anything to get to the divine because I'm already there, I just have to improve my knowing. Can both people find growth and spiritual sustenance in the Enneagram without modifying their beliefs one way or the other?
Sure. Though my publisher is sort of known for publishing quite a few pretty conservative evangelical authors and books, I really did try to write this in as interspiritual sort of language as possible, realizing that the target audience of the publisher would be within a majority of evangelical consumers. My sense is this, though, and my sense is that regardless of what your faith tradition is, your religious community, your sort of starting point for your notions of God might be, that I would sort of argue that within every great world religion, within every great wisdom tradition, we would fundamentally sort of agree that all of this is rooted in love, and that what we mean by love is probably what we mean by God. And I think one of the gifts of the Enneagram is it actually helps us connect with that love, that divine nature. So, you know, Father Richard Hauser, who's a Jesuit at Creighton University, and he's written some really great books, wrote this little book years ago called Moving in the Spirit. And the subtitle's fabulous. It's called Becoming Contemplative in Action. And actually in that book, Father Richard Hauser talks about this notion of Western spirituality, Western sort of Christianity that actually separates humanity from God. And he really sort of exposes that as the fallacy that it is. In fact, what Richard Hauser does, Father Hauser does in this book, it says that in a biblical notion of totally understanding ourselves in relationship to God, there's no separation, but there's only overlap. And that grace isn't something that we sort of reach out for or ask for or have to conceptually receive so that we can be saved, because fundamentally, if that's what we think we're doing, then actually we're saving ourselves. He says, if we're in God and God is in us, grace is the being. Like you said, it's the coming to know that. It's the imagining the essence and the connection and the impression of that essence. And that's, I think, also what the Enneagram is showing us, that for a lot of us, it heals our notions of God. And for others of us, it heals our notions of sin. I actually take issue, and I do a lot of the work of this in my book, by saying that the passions, this emotional longing that we have to reconnect with essence, to reconnect with divine love, isn't these passions, these nine passions of the Enneagram, aren't first and foremost sins. Now, sin language has been put on them, but they're really just, It's our best effort. It's the rudimentary tool that we have to try to find our way home. And yes, it's wholly inadequate, and it's not going to be enough. It's just like a little keychain flashlight, and you being lost in a forest in the middle of the night. We're never going to get out with this tool, but it's the first tool we're given. It's our starting point, and that starting point, I think, heals our notion of self, heals our notion of God, and I think really heals this perception of the disconnect, if we actually think there is one.
What are the three lies that you talk about in your book?
Sure. So Father Henry Nouwen, who is a great spiritual teacher, who is just a beautiful author of incredible works, died in the 90s, had this amazing teaching where he just said, fundamentally, we all believe, because we don't know who we are, we all believe a version of these three lies: that I am what I have, I am what I do, and I am what other people say about me. And, you know, I think that's true. I think if we're honest, we all sort of find ourselves bouncing between those. But I also think we probably attach to one of those more than we do the others.
And the Enneagram would help us discern which of those lies we identify with most. Is that correct?
Sure. So one of the things that the Enneagram shows us, besides the sort of energies around these nine types, is these various triads, right? And so the first triad of the Enneagram is called the intelligence centers. And the intelligence centers are either your body or your instincts, your heart or your feelings, and your head or your thoughts. And we all have these, and we all can access, of course, our instincts, our feelings, and our rational abilities. But we all have a dominant center, and that dominant center, our preferred center, really is the container where our type lands. So if you look at the Enneagram, types 8, 9, and 1 are in their body, right? They experience life as too much, so the 8s fight back, the 9s withdrawals, the 1s try to fix it. Types 2, 3, and 4 in their hearts. These are the feeling forward types who read the emotional energy of someone else better than their own. And then types 5, 6, and 7, those folks are way up there in their head. They're threat forecasting. They're trying to figure everything out. Well, my sense is this: if we take these three lies, I am what I have, I am what I do, and I am what other people say about me, and we align them with our intelligence centers, I actually think that those of us in our body, the gut types, really do over-identify with this lie, I am what I do, right? 8s, I fight for justice. 9s, I reconcile and mediate. 1s, I fix things. I think this lie, I am what other people say or think about me, really resonates with people in their hearts. 2s, who are so giving and loving, need to be recognized for that. 3s, who are caricatured as these sort of achievers, want to be rewarded as a substitute for the childhood wound of what their own disconnect from their heart was. And the 4s, right, these individualists, these romantics, they just want to be seen. And then this lie, I am what I have, I think really aligns with those in the head centers, right? If you're dominant type 5, I have the answers. If you're dominant type 6, I have stability. And if you're dominant type 7, I have freedom. And I think these three lies really connect to the core of who we are. Because the centers, the intelligence centers of the Enneagram, are really the starting point for knowing ourselves. The childhood wounds of the Enneagram are childhood wounds first and foremost, either to the mind, to the heart, or to the body. And this is where we begin to sort of fall asleep. These lies are the illusions that keep us from waking up.
Is there any Enneagram conclusion that is essentially more healthy, more grounded, more spiritually advanced than the other? Than the others, I should say.
Wait, sorry, is there any Enneagram?
Is there, if you were going to, let's say, create the ideal perfect person, let's say you were going to take the Enneagram test and pretend you're Jesus or Buddha, are you going to, and answer all of the questions in supposedly the most enlightened way, is there a conclusion? Is there an end result that you could read and go, wow, that is like the most spiritually grounded, giving, compassionate profile I've ever seen in my life? Or does every single Enneagram result have both a positive and a negative?
Sure. So that's unfortunately one of the ways I think the Enneagram has been misunderstood, is that it leads with negatives. Now, Oscar Chazo, the man who really we have to credit for sort of bringing forward the raw material of the Enneagram of personality, which is what we primarily work with today, started with the mental fixations and sort of taught that if you can understand how you get stuck mentally, then you can understand sort of how to get unstuck and get free. So my sense is the best type or the best sort of conclusion or the best outcome here when you're working with the Enneagram or the most beautiful soul or most evolved or enlightened human being is you. It's you at your best. It's you owning the gifts of your essence. It's you doing your inner work with what you learn about your type. And it's not wanting to be another type It's being the best of your type that you can be yourself. This, I think, is sort of a correction as well, because, you know, in the Enneagram, you see these lines crossing through this circle, and these lines point to either what's called your heart point or your path of integration or your soul child, and they also point to your stress point or your path of disintegration. And some of us get confused that if I can just integrate to my heart point, if I can just integrate to my soul child, I've done the work. I've woken up. I'm enlightened. I'm whole. But the truth is we need to be the best version of ourself that we can be. And if you're dominant in type 2, if you're dominant in type 5, if you're dominant in type 9, you need to be the best 2 or 5 or 9 that you can. And that's the conclusion. I mean, I think that's not the goal here, but that's the grace of being on the journey.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella. With me today, Christopher Huerts. He's the author of The Sacred Enneagram, Finding Your Unique Path to Spiritual Growth. Christopher, you write about how some secular institutions, you mentioned the CIA, you mentioned Stanford University, they are using the Enneagram. And of course, again, they're secular institutions. They're not really concerned about spiritual growth, I don't think. I find this similar to how in recent years meditation has been used in very secular settings. Hatha yoga is used in secular settings, and to some degree, even Jewish Kabbalah. And some people have said that these deeply religious / spiritual traditions have been neutered from their religious roots. How do you feel about the Enneagram in that sort of company being used for purely secular reasons as opposed to spiritual?
Sure. That's a good question. When I see this showing up in different places, and I do actually some corporate teachings, I do some leadership in Enneagram workshops. I do a little bit of this. What it says is that this teaching that's contained, that's being sort of refracted through the Enneagram, is so pregnant with possibilities that it does have application in all areas of life. The problem is, just like all of us, we live fragmented lives, and the lack of integration really is what sort of, it doesn't delegitimize any of these teachings or applications or uses, but it doesn't give us sort of a fuller sense of what they could actually offer. And so, you know, if the folks at Stanford, if the folks at Google, if the folks at the CIA, if others can appeal to this, what you'd hope is that's sort of the on-ramp. That's the on-ramp to really taking this deeper so that it really can be sort of the sacred map to our souls so that we know what our inner work is. And so we know how to align our mindfulness intentions, our contemplative practices, or our spirituality with.
I do know a number of people who started taking, say, meditation courses or hatha yoga courses in purely secular settings, it opened the door for them, and they searched deeper because all of a sudden a switch did get clicked. That, oh, wait a minute here, there is something, I could go deeper, couldn't I? And then they move in one direction or another. What do you think is the best way to take a test? There are plenty of them online. Do you recommend taking them online? And if so, what are the best sources? And then what do you do once you've taken the test? You've certainly indicated that you don't just take a test and go, oh, great, I'm a 9. Okay, thank you very much. Log off.
Yeah. So this is actually, I think it gets a little nerdy for some people, but I actually think the sort of coming to your type is a really important conversation to have. The easiest way to discern type is, yeah, get online and take a test. And there's a ton of them out there, and there's a lot of free ones. The free one that I point people to can be found in the Enya app, which you can download on your smartphone. But I think the best test that you could take online is the RETI, the R-H-E-T-I. And I think it's $10 or $12, and that's through the Enneagram Institute. But look, I have to say this. The tests simply are like any other test. They have their backloaded assumptions, inherent racial bias, cultural sort of norms that sort of hold them. And so you'll see this. You'll see that sometimes the tests actually aren't effective. You know, some of us test tests. Some of us don't actually honestly answer the question as we are, but who we want to be or who we want to be seen as. And so the tests, as helpful as they are, can also be unhelpful. Another way to bring type forward is to find someone who's been trained in a typing process, which is could be a 45-minute to 90-minute inquiry, where somebody who can nuancingly ask you questions around the energies of the nine types allow you to bring your types forward and for you to discover it yourself. A third way is what's called panel work. And this is where you may be at an Enneagram workshop or training, and they'll call all the folks up who are dominant in type three, sit them on a panel, and then someone who's been trained to sort of interview this panel to show how different, let's say, 10 individuals are who share the same type can be. They're also trained to sort of pull forward the commonalities. You know, the problem with panels, though, is when somebody doesn't know their type or they've mistyped and they get up there and they sort of convolute it for everyone else. The fourth way, and I think this actually might be the first way to do this, is just to read the thick descriptions of each of the nine types and to let those thick descriptions sort of be mirrors that you look into and see if you can see yourself looking back. Once you discover type, though, yeah, I that's when this journey really begins. And there's plenty of books out there that you can buy, you can pick up, you can turn to the chapter of your type, read 27 pages, set the book down, and be done with it. But I actually don't think that's sort of what we want. My sense is what we want is to really go deeper, to really align type with contemplative practice, and to really align sort of contemplative practice to sort of the healing of that disconnect from essence and that disconnect from divine love.
As a facilitator yourself, do you find that part of your job is keeping the person you're working with honest? When you say that people can answer questions to suit their idealized self, do you have the ability to go, are you sure that this is who you are? I'm not seeing this. Or do you simply allow the process to happen and comment at face value?
I really try to let people own their journey. I really try to sort of let people be patient and compassionate with themselves. Because here's the thing, some of us aren't ready to sort of see what's true about ourselves. Some of us need to do a little bit more groundwork to get there. Now, if I'm doing one-on-one work with someone and I'm afraid that they've mistyped or it's obvious that they've mistyped, then yeah, we will appeal to some of those inquiry questions in the typing process. I also will do this. So when I'm doing prolonged one-on-one work with somebody, if it's over a year or two, is at a certain point challenge them on the assumptions on whether or not they've typed right, even if I think they have, because I do think that at a certain point in our life, we do need to return to our base assumptions about who we are, re-interrogate those and own those in new ways. And so if we've been doing one-on-one work for 16 months and I sort of try to knock you off your heels and say, hey, actually, I don't think you're type six. And I've been wondering this for a long time. What that does is that helps you return to, if you're dominant in type six, really, what was it that helped me get here? And how have I grown in compassion for myself since I arrived? And I think that also can be such a gift.
We're coming down to the end of this episode, but briefly, you mentioned racial and ethnic bias. Can you give us an example? How would that play into a test?
Well, So, you know, this is really one of the great laments of the modern Enneagram community today, is that it's largely made up of older white Western teachers. And we really are in an urgent need for there to be younger people of color, more women who can really become experts and luminaries in the field here. It's ironic because Oscar Ichazo and Claudio Naranjo, a Bolivian and a Chilean man, are really credited for bringing this forward. These are two men who were teaching this to us in a second language. These are two men who brought this out of a different hemisphere, and somehow we've been able to sort of honor the seed of the teaching. But I'm afraid that in a lot of ways it's become very Westernized, and I think that gets back to the sort of hybrid uses of this in leadership or in business, or you know, not doing your own inner work with the Enneagram, but seeing these trainings or these books come out on the Enneagram and teams and team dynamics. Look, all of that's important, but it's gotten away from where it needed to start.
Sure. And go on.
And I think what that also is an invitation to is realizing that this isn't just one sort of, there's not just one cultural bias that dominates this narrative. And so, like I said, there really is some need for some urgent work in that area.
Briefly, Christopher, if people have any more questions or curiosities, aside from reading your book, some websites to visit.
Sure. So you can go to sacredenneagram.org, and there's a list there of the workshops that we do, not just in North America, but really all over the world. You can also learn more a little bit about the work that we do in terms of contemplative formation and contemplative activism at gravitycenter.com. And anyone who's listening, regardless of faith tradition or background, are always welcome at any of the retreats or workshops that we host.
Wonderful. Christopher, thank you so much for being here this week and last week as well.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Really, really great talking.
You've been listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today has been Christopher Hewerts, the author of The Sacred Enneagram, Finding Your Unique Path to Spiritual Growth. Please join us again next week here on Common Threads.